Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Mesa City Council study session for March the 3rd. We excuse Vice Mayor Kavanaugh, who is absent today. The first item on our agenda is to hear a presentation and discuss an update on the Police Department's Forensic Services Division. Please step forward. We know we've got a great Forensic Services Division. We're anxious to hear more about it.
Hey.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I'm Kim Mesa. I am the Forensic Services Administrator for Forensic Services. And this morning, I am going to be giving a presentation on some of the major successes that the Forensic Services Laboratory had this past year. But I would like to start by introducing the management team and the leadership of the lab that is responsible for the accomplishments we had. To my left is Sarah Fredericks. She is the Quality Assurance Manager for our laboratory. And then behind me is Krista Placco. You want to stand. She is our biology supervisor, which is body fluid identification and DNA unit. Behind her is Ray Van Orden, and he supervises our toxicology unit. Next to him is Steve Valdez, and Steve supervises our controlled substances unit as well as our firearms unit. Next to him is Kelly Speckles. She supervises our latent print unit and our fingerprint identification unit. Next to her is Charlene Gutierrez, and she is our supervisor of our administrative business unit as well as our lab technician unit. And next to her is Geneva Meza, who supervises our crime scene unit as well as our evidence processing unit. And then absent today is Joanne Pogreba-Dykstra, who supervises our photo unit as well as oversees all of our grants and our security and safety of our building. What I also have passed out to each of you is a brochure. It's for you to take. Inside, it talks about our units and what they do. So you'll have that for later. And then on the very back is what I'm going to be talking about today, which is the accomplishments we had this past year. Our laboratory is staffed with 70 forensic services members, and they are divided into the units you see on the slide here. And really what happened was about 3.5 years ago, the vision of our laboratory changed. And we started working towards, as a management team, towards becoming real time. And to give you an idea, you know, what does that mean? Real time for us means that we wanted to be able to process evidence as efficiently as possible, meaning without backlogs, without any cases waiting in the queue. So as samples and cases came in, we started processing them right away and getting those out through the door. The philosophy behind that was just that a strong belief that forensic science should be used in every case, from minor crimes to major crimes, and that this should be something our citizens have a right to in all of their cases. And nationwide, this seems to be actually a problem for forensic science laboratories to be able to accomplish this. So for this goal to be accomplished, each supervisor evaluated what they needed to do to do this. They evaluated what technology they needed, and then they found the funding to get that technology. They reviewed the staffing and determined based on the demand, what we needed, and then we went through hiring and training of that staff. And then they also identified how, based on the backlogs we currently had, how to eliminate those and then how to keep current. So I'm very proud to say that in 2015, 7 out of our 9 analytical units met this goal and became real time. And it's our anticipated goal and expectation that this year the last 2 units will also meet that goal. This makes us a very unique lab in the state of Arizona and even nationwide. So the brochures that I handed out back, I'm not going to go over all of them, but I'll hit some of the major points that talk about what we did. Our laboratory processed over 35,000 requests last year. We became internationally accredited with ISO 17025, and we were listed as one of the top 25 forensic science internships in the nation. And we have a very strong internship program that actually brings in students from all over the country. Currently, 8 of our employees began as interns and are now full-time staff with us. And then, of course, we hit our real-time goal in 7 out of our 9 units. So for biology, Real time for them means that we are turning around cases in 32 days. That means from the point that a case comes into us, regardless of the type of crime, a report is going out in 32 days. We do have the capability of going faster in major crimes, but this is just our routine in and out is 32 days. The other major thing that I think people perhaps are unaware of is that especially as we become real-time, we're more investigative and assisting of our customers. And since 2010 to now, the biology unit had a 41% CODIS hit rate. And CODIS is our national DNA database. And so in these cases, they tend to be very low clearance rates for our customers. And we are able to provide an investigative lead and a name 41% of the time, which is one of the reasons that Mesa has a high clearance rate in our property crimes compared to some of the other sister cities here in Arizona. We also, the biology unit has created a partnership with the University of Virginia, and we are going to be assisting them in testing some brand new technology that they have created that's not available on the market. Based on our partnership with them, we'll be reporting back, most likely publishing some papers presenting on that, and also would be able to keep the instrument because of the work we did with them. Our crime scene unit, all of our crime scene specialists are internationally certified investigators, and we also have two members that are certified in forensic photography. This is a very rare certification. There's 70 people in the entire world who have this certification. There's 10 in the United States, and two of those are here in Mesa. So, for our evidence processing unit, they turn around cases in 34 days, and that unit also has a certified forensic artist, which is also a very rare certification, and this individual has training and the ability to do skull reconstructions. Our latent print unit turns around cases in about 30 days, and on our toxicology unit, which for blood alcohol turns around cases in about 7 days, and our blood drugs in about 90 days. So what does that mean? That probably doesn't have a big impact on 30 days, and is that good? So the slide that I have there for you to take a look at is a comparison to all of our Arizona crime labs in here. The first thing I want to say is that taking us back to 2012, we were very consistent with all the other laboratories, and those were also our turnaround times, very much in the exact same place that those other labs are. And so that shows you a little bit the progress that we've accomplished here in the last 3.5 years is taking us from where everybody else still currently is to where we are now. Also, where this is how many days it takes to get things done. Where we were sitting when we started with backlogs is we had about 500 cases in the queue for DNA that were waiting for testing, and about over 2,000 cases in toxicology that were waiting. So very overwhelming, and I just wanted to acknowledge that because of the feat of this goal was what the overwhelmingness of it, and then the ability to actually stay focused on the goal over this long term to actually make it happen. It certainly wasn't something we were capable of doing overnight. It took quite a bit. In 2016, the last two units we expect to go real time, controlled substances and firearms. Some of the other things we're working on in those units is adding a field drug testing instrument to our customers that would allow them to do field drug testing in heroin, which is not a capability we currently have. Our firearms unit, NIBIN, is the database that allows us to compare shell casings to other, so firearms cases to firearms cases. We are designing a program with ATF and as well as our partner with Mesa PD, the Career Criminal Squad, to allow us to link firearms cases more readily and solve crimes that way. Toxicology, one of the other things we'll be adding this year is a new instrument that allows us to test for additional compounds other than ethanol that allow or that look for impairment. And so this would be like your propellants and things people are inhaling. And also that instrument's going to give us the capability of detecting date rape drugs, which is something we currently cannot do. With that instrument, we will be the only crime lab in Arizona that has the capabilities of those two things. And then the last thing that I did not put on the slide, but another thing that we're working towards is this year is adding a new service, which is fire debris analysis, which is currently something that when we investigate that here in Mesa, those cases get sent to the Arizona DPS Crime Laboratory. And once we have that service on, they would remain here in our own laboratory. So I would anticipate the next question would be, how are we able to do this? Why are we different from these other labs, and how could we turn things around so quickly? And I believe there's actually some very clear reasons why we were able to. One of the major things is our laboratory is data-driven. We use the CompStat model, which means that we have a true awareness of what our workload is and what our capabilities are, which helps us design what we needed. We have very clear vision and missions. We set six-month goals, and we have biannual management meetings where all of the management team gets together, says where we were, where we're going, and then the next month, did we accomplish it, and how to change it moving towards forward. And that is something we do religiously. We have strong training for our customers so that they understand our capabilities and are utilizing us properly. We have strong case acceptance policies, which means we work smarter. We don't work evidence that does not make sense or is not beneficial to the case. We have been very successful in grant funding. We get anywhere from $250,000 to $500,000 a year, which helps us bring in new technology and stay current. And then finally, and what I find to be most important, especially as I talk to the other crime laboratories in Arizona, is the support from our city. Our facility is very complex, and we have a great facilities maintenance department that assists us with that. All of our systems in the laboratory are paperless, which means all of our data from our instruments and everything being transposed. And that is supported by our police department, IT department. And then also the city itself and council for staffing and for us being able to purchase our equipment and stay efficient. So for that, we would like to thank all of you. And with that, I'll take any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Kim. Very impressive. Mr. Luna.
Kim, thank you so much. I've been to your lab. It's quite impressive. You guys do a tremendous job.
Thank you.
You talked about the interns. Where do they get their training? And then that's one question. And the other one is your grant writer. Do you have a full-time grant writer that looks specifically for these type of grant opportunities?
Okay. Mayor and Council, good questions. Okay, so our internships are actually designed. They apply through the website for City of Mesa and go through our volunteer coordinator at the police department. We are looking, there's specific requirements. They need to be a junior or senior in college, and they need to have a certain amount of chemistry and science and biology science club courses. If they meet that, when they come in, based on the projects that we have, we assign them and train them in-house. And like I said, very successful because it has allowed us to utilize extra staff to get accomplished, bringing on mostly technology, because it, for us to bring that in, it's beneficial to the city, but also takes us away from doing work to get those online. And the assistance of the interns have been wonderful for that. So people apply that way, and then they go through the interview process and actually come in. They do a background in polygraph as well. And then, yes, the grants. I do actually have one of my supervisors manages our grants. However, it is kind of spread around between all of the managers. So our biology supervisor does her own grants for that area. And basically, there are several grants that are funded for crime laboratories: full service crime lab grants, Coverdell grants. And the DNA backlog reduction grants. So those every year get funded, and then we apply for them and get awarded. And then if there's competitive grants that come open, then usually the supervisor that is assigned to the grants will work towards filling out the applications and turning them in. So. Okay, thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Finter.
Just earlier in your presentation, you said, so what does this mean? What does this mean? I can tell you what it means. You guys are amazing. And when you talk to other agencies, they always point to Mesa's amazing forensics unit, the crime lab. In fact, I think we've been very helpful in surrounding agencies to handle some of the high-profile situations. You have a great business relationship with Gilbert, so you're able to utilize some of these services and generate revenue to be able to cover costs. And so you're second to none. We appreciate I know there was a tremendous investment by the prior councils and bonds and others to build this facility and to get this where it's at. So really appreciate all the work. Just so you know, you mentioned CODIS and these property crime clearance rates. The citizen on the street sees that and I've been told more times than I can remember, wow, I had a burglary, I felt violated, the police were there, but when the forensic unit showed up and they were taking DNA from some blood, or someone left a pop cam behind, heard one recently about kind of a smudge mark that they were able to do, and they're coming up with these individuals that are doing a majority of the crime in areas and property crimes, they love it. It is a PR tool that leads when people have had some tough situations. So they feel like they're really getting a great service. So I appreciate what you do, and have always heard nothing but the best about the unit. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Luna.
Just real quick, when we had the gay nights in November, Kim went with me and with Chief Mesa, and they didn't want to listen to me. That when we went into these neighborhoods, they didn't want to listen to the chief, but they wanted to listen to Kim, because I said, well, she's the CSI of Mesa. So they asked her a number of questions. There was a lot of interest, and thank you. Thank you for your effort, and thank you for being with us on our tour. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you again. This is my first opportunity to hear about the crime lab. I've heard, like Mr. Fender, from lots of people, you guys have the best crime lab around. And I knew that, but I didn't know the why. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. And again, I thank you to the prior councils that have invested in giving you the tools and giving you this beautiful building and the great equipment that you need. But it still wouldn't happen without you making it happen. So I love the idea of maybe having a Mesa CSI Channel 11 television show. So let's work on that.
They get way better ratings than we do.
That's right. Make sure it doesn't conflict with city council meetings, because we know what people would watch. But thank you very much. We're very proud of you. It's nice to be as good as we can be in something. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I think we have a common theme going here. Another great organization at the City of Mesa is Falcon Field Airport. And Corrine Nystrom, we're happy to have you here to update us on events out at Falcon Field. Congratulations. I know we came out and cut the ribbon at a beautiful terminal. I'd hate to steal your thunder. That's probably what you're about to
talk about. Well, that's going to be part of my thunder, but there's plenty of additional thunder here.
Okay.
So let's see here. Oh, thank you. Oh, back down to here.
And then hit this little presentation there.
Awesome. Thank you, Jill. Jill is great, by the way.
Here she is.
So square away here.
Yeah. Jill, maybe you can present next time.
Exactly. Okay. Or you can help me if I stumble in my presentation. Okay. Good morning. My name's Corrine Nystrom, and I'm the airport director at Falcon Field Airport. And I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank you for allowing me to come here this morning to provide you with an update on some of the really cool things that are happening at the airport. Uh-huh. Okay. I think I'm going to need Jill here. All right. We have a lot of great things going on, and I'm going to kind of walk you through some of those. And so as we do that, I would just like for you to sit back, relax, and enjoy the little flight here. That was an aircraft that just came to Falcon Field just a few days ago. A brand new aircraft, about $90 million purchase price. I'm going to share with you a little bit about what we're doing and where we are with the airport today, but I'd also like to spend some time focusing on the direction that the airport is headed here over the next several years. Let's start with safety, because safety is always a big priority at our airport as well as every other airport in the United States. Over the last 5 years, approximately $5.7 million has been spent at Falcon Field just for safety enhancements on the airfield itself. As you can see, the areas that are shown in green are those areas of the airport that have received some type of enhancement over the last 5 years. Now, airports are a little bit like European cathedrals. They're always under construction. They're always getting new enhancements. And so over the next 5 years, our plan is to invest another $16.8 million into additional safety enhancements in the airfield itself. And you'll see that, the green area, the overlay, is also the area where more improvements will be made. These are just additional enhancements that are going to be made in the specific runway, taxiway areas of the airport. And moving to another part of the airport, we have been very successful with our city-owned hangar fire inspection program that we've been having for the last 3 to 4 years. We've been successful in conducting over 500 hangar inspections, and I'm really pleased to say that all 400-plus city-owned hangars that we have at the airport have now gotten a pass mark on their inspection report. And so what you've seen is we've taken aircraft storage hangars from what you see a picture on the left to what you see a picture on the right. Now, I'm going to qualify there. Those are two different hangars. So the guys that are smiling there are not the ones that have the cars in the hangar. But we're going to continue to do these inspections on an ongoing basis just because we have made so much progress there that we want to make sure that we continue to have safe hangars. Our next step is to work in cooperation with the fire department to begin performing fire inspections again in the privately owned hangars and buildings at the airport. It's not, it's really not just the appropriate thing to do the city-owned hangars, but we really need to also make sure that all of our hangars and buildings at the airport are safe and meet the current code requirements. Now, community engagement is a big part of what we do at Falcon Field. One of the things that we always try to remember is that our tenants and our users have a choice about where they base their aviation businesses and where they base their aircraft. And so we believe that it's really important for us to reach out to those businesses and those tenants and to extend our thanks to them for their loyalty and continued support at Falcon Field. So we do hold several events for them throughout the year to just basically say thank you, and we appreciate them continuing to choose Falcon Field. Now, the Fly Friendly program at the airport, which is the program that focuses on being a good neighbor, continues to be a very high priority as well. Over the past several years, 18 fly-friendly strategies have been implemented at the airport. Those strategies were recommended by members of the community as well as airport tenants back in 2009, and we feel as though we've been very successful in getting those implemented. On top of that, the large flight academy that is located at Falcon Field has taken upon themselves to come up with some additional voluntary strategies that they have implemented in order to continue to reduce the amount of aircraft noise that might be affecting the neighbors. Airport staff continues to respond to every noise complaint that we get. Interesting part of it is right now the majority of the complaints that we are receiving are about aircraft that depart from Falcon Field but that are flying in Apache Junction, Queen Creek, and Gold Canyon. But even though they're not located within Mesa, we are still responding to those complaints as well. The community tenant check-in meetings that Councilmember Luna is always very actively involved with are another way that we are able to reach out to both the community and to the tenants to hear their comments on how we can continue to be a good neighbor and to also give them the opportunity to share ideas that they may have if they have some suggestions on how we can continue to reduce the amount of aircraft noise effect on the neighbors. Our annual open house is a big event, and I'm going to talk about that in just a few minutes, but it's a great opportunity for people to come out and spend a day at the airport. Our airport tour program continues to be thriving, and it is a great way of showcasing the airport to all kinds of people and different groups ranging in age from preschoolers, our future pilots and future airport directors, and to senior citizens. We have a new event coming to Falcon Field in October. The Copper State Fly-In will be held at Falcon Field on October 28th and 29th. Now, since 1973, the Copper State Fly-In has been bringing aviation enthusiasts together from throughout this, mostly the Southwest United States, to help promote general aviation through its events, through its scholarship program, and through its public education. Copper State is the fourth largest general aviation fly-in event in the United States and generally attracts around 500 aircraft from across the country during a 3 to 4 day period. This is the first time that the fly-in will be held at Falcon Field, and we're very excited about having them here. And we know that if you come out to that event, you'll be able to see some really cool airplanes. There are approximately 3,000 general aviation airports that are acknowledged by the Federal Aviation Administration here in the United States. Of those 3,000 airports, Falcon Field, according to FAA data, is the fifth most active of those airports. Our estimated annual economic impact is approximately $2 billion. Our operating revenues continue to be stable at approximately $3.5 to $4 million a year. And we are one of the very few airports in the United States, including airports that provide commercial airline service, one of the very few airports that can say that we are actually financially self-sustaining. And what that means is that the revenues that are generated at Falcon Field are generated by the users. We do not derive any of our revenues from the city's general fund. And so the bottom line is, if you don't use Falcon Field Airport, you're not paying for Falcon Field Airport. It's the users who are paying for it. Now, what you see here is some data, and data is always a really good indicator of what reality is. This graph shows the annual aircraft operations at Falcon Field since 1990, as reported by the Federal Aviation Administration. Now, if you look at this data, you will see that our operations have grown since 1990. But if you look at the red trend line, you will see that over time, that growth has not climbed as much as a lot of people may think it has. We did have a few years where it did spike, but now our numbers are down to what we believe to be a more manageable number in terms of airspace and operations. If you look at the graph even further, you will see that our current operations are actually less than what they were between the years of 1999 and 2003. The mayor mentioned our great new terminal building. We're really excited about that. We had the ribbon cutting for that back in December. And I can tell you that it really, really does enhance the first impression that visitors get when they arrive at Falcon Field, and really sends a good message out about Mesa and the great community that we are. And we thank you for your support on that. We're also implementing some new and innovative features to help create more of a sense of place at Falcon Field in fun and interactive ways. And our Air Lab public viewing area, located next to the terminal building, is just one example of how Falcon Field is continuing to set itself apart from other general aviation airports. Now, we are very, very proud of Falcon Field's past. We're also very proud of the fact that today Falcon Field continues to be a major economic engine for Mesa. And this is demonstrated by the 93 businesses that are currently located on the airport. Those businesses employ over 1,300 people in a variety of positions. And we track those numbers on an annual basis. And when we looked back, to 2013, you can see that just since 2013, over 300 new jobs have been created at Falcon Field by these businesses. Economic development also includes taking pride in the appearance of our airport. The airport planned area development standards that City Council approved a few years ago have really been beneficial in helping us to transform the appearance of the airport when it comes to some of the buildings and structures. The photographs you see here are of the same building. The orange building was what the building looked like before the tenant voluntarily chose to invest funds to bring his building up to the current PAD standards. And you can see there's a major difference there. I'm pleased to announce that we have a new restaurant at Falcon Field, in addition to the Monastery restaurant, which is still there. Steak and Stone has opened up. They are currently at the former location of the Anzio Landing restaurant at Higley Road and Falcon Drive. And I would really invite all of you to come out and enjoy their great menu while sitting there and just watching the airplanes take off and land. We're really excited to have them there. The airport works in very close cooperation with the City Economic Development Department in order to further economic growth at the airport and in the northeast part of Mesa. One of the things that we work especially well together on is our business retention and expansion. And I am very pleased to say that over the last 2 to 3 years, we've had several existing airport businesses go through some pretty major expansion modes, which is partly one reason why you see the additional 300 jobs at the airport. We also work together on national outreach and marketing, and this includes attendance at national trade shows such as the National Business Aviation Association and the Heli Expo trade shows. There are currently 2 city employees, one from the airport and one from economic development, who are in Louisville, Kentucky, as we speak, at the Heli Expo trade show. As we move forward into the future, we want to continue to acknowledge and show respect for Falcon Field's rich history. Steps are currently being taken to, in cooperation with the State Historic Preservation Office, to nominate the 2 original hangars that were constructed at Falcon Field during World War II to the National Register of Historic Places. The state will be considering this one more time on March 25th, and if they are agreeable to it, then they will move forward and submit the nomination directly to the federal government. So stay tuned. We'll keep you posted on how that turns out. Our social media and internet marketing is also an important part of our marketing plan. For example, we are in the final stages of doing a complete redesign of our website to, in our opinion, really help promote the airport a little bit better as a thriving economic hub of activity. Social media is so huge today that we have to stay one step ahead of that. Now, one area that we have been focusing on, but we're going to actually put a little more emphasis on it over the next few years, is working on the appearance of the aircraft parking ramps as well as some of the ground lease parcels. We're going to be working directly with the tenants to assist them in either screening or removing some of their equipment and non-airworthy aircraft, because we believe that it is really important for Mesa's premier general aviation airport to be as attractive and as appealing as possible, not only so that our citizens have something to be really proud of, but also to help us in our future economic development endeavors. So that will be a major focus for us over the next few years. The new covered aircraft wash rack, the design is almost complete. We're planning to put that out to bid later this spring and hopefully start construction this summer. This is a project that the tenants at the airport have been asking for a long, long time. And I'm really pleased to say that we're just about to that point where we're going to be able to deliver on that promise to get them their facility. Once it's completed, we are confident that it is going to be the premier aircraft wash facility in the United States that all other airports will aspire to have. The historic zone improvement project is also moving along very well. Ritok Powell, who is the consultant on this project, is in the process of finalizing some conceptual ideas that they will be presenting to city management. We look forward to sharing those concepts with you as well over the next several months once they are presented to us. But I'm going to just give you a little quick preview on a couple of areas that we've been talking about. First of all, let's talk about our public viewing areas, because everybody likes to look at aircraft. So we currently have a viewing area at the terminal building and just directly adjacent to the terminal building. And what we would like to do with that is to not only add some additional enhancements to it, but also to possibly expand it so that it's a little larger and they have a little better view of some of the aircraft. What we would also like to do is to construct a new viewing area that is in very close proximity to Falcon Field Park. Because right now, when people come to the park to enjoy the park amenities, there really isn't any place where they can then go to actually watch the airplanes. And so what we would like to do is mesh the two together and create a public viewing area where people can enjoy the park, but then walk over and enjoy watching the aircraft. So we think that's going to be a really great addition to the airport. Another creative idea that they've come up with is to provide some exterior enhancements to our city-owned hangars, especially the ones that are in view of the public along Falcon Drive. And one of the concepts they've come up with is to do some nighttime downlighting features on the hangars to just kind of make them sparkle in the evenings without, of course, affecting aircraft operations. Another idea that they've come up with is to take the hangar complex and to identify areas within that complex that would commemorate specific types of aircraft that were seen at Falcon Field during World War II. Then what they would do, what we would do then is a lot of those hangars need to be repainted. And so what we would be looking to do is to repaint them to include some markings that are representative of those aircraft that were seen here at the airport during World War II. A lot of fun stuff. So before we move on to the next presentation, I just want to invite all of you to come to the 8th annual Falcon Field Open House that is scheduled to be held on Saturday, March 26th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Great opportunity to see some awesome aircraft, some classic cars, great food, just a really all-around good time. And as always in the past and this year as well, admission is free. So everyone come on down for that. So I'd like to thank you for your continued support of Falcon Field Airport. And I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Corrine. Again, very, very impressive presentation. We're very proud of Falcon Field Airport, and kudos to you. I'm at the risk of sounding like I'm just trying to flatter you. I get a lot of compliments on the good job you do at Falcon. You have a very tough job. Managing an airport that's located in the middle of a residential neighborhood is just an invitation for conflict. And you manage that remarkably well. People on all sides of every issue out there, the one thing they all agree on is that they respect you and they appreciate the good faith effort that you put into resolving all the conflicts that are just inherent in managing an airport. So thank you for the great job you've done, and a lot of really impressive progress. So thank you very much. And also to Mr. Luna, who is very passionate about Falcon. Thank you, Mr. Luna.
Thank you, Corrine, for a wonderful job. You're a great administrator. We're so happy that we have you here in the city of Mesa. And thank your staff, and thank you for maintaining the hangars and making sure that they're clean. And just aesthetically, the airport just looks so much nicer. And, you know, people laugh about the plane wash, whatever you call it. I think that's going to bring people in who fly from all over the valley just to wash their planes. So hopefully that'll be an economic boost for our Falcon Field. And I want to encourage my colleagues to come to the open house. It's a lot of fun. You get to see a lot of kids and a lot of planes, and it's a great time to really enjoy Mesa and to really enjoy Falcon Field. So again, thank you for the tremendous job that you do at the airport. I appreciate that. And thank Natalie back there too, because we work in concert. So
yes, we sure work really well together.
We're quite appreciative of what she does as well. Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a great airport. Mesa really has a real gem.
You know, the historic hangars that are out there, I would say really are, if you live in Mesa and you haven't had the opportunity to visit those historic hangars, you're really missing out. They really are, I would say, the coolest buildings in the city of Mesa are these World War II airplane hangars that are at Falcon Field. So I hope everyone comes to the open house on the 26th and gets the opportunity to see those.
Great.
Thanks again for being so customer service oriented and doing a great job.
That's
Council, any other comments or questions about this? Thank you. So
we'll move into the next part of it. Right?
Great. Thank you. I didn't know if you were going to help us with that one as well.
Well, I am.
Good.
I don't know if the sound's going to work, but I believe Bill Jabginiak is going to come up here, and we're going to visit a little bit about a new proposed development.
Good morning, Mayor. Good morning, Council.
Morning, Bill.
It's always good to be back in front of you, and it's a great opportunity to partner with Corrine. We've been, she mentioned, working hard on business retention efforts, but there's a little more to it than that. And I really, about a year and a half ago, under then-Mayor Finter's leadership, we developed the Falcon Field Economic Activity Strategic Plan. And that was really done to establish the strategic direction for the business side and really business attraction side of what's on the airport and the non-residential areas in Northeast Mesa in total. So one of those goals was to build awareness and to increase visibility and aggressively market that area. And from that, we really had input from focus groups, surveys, developers, a little bit of everyone. And from that, really developed this logo that you see here up on the screen. And it really embodies the history of Falcon Field and also describes the focus for job growth within the district. So while we've always been strong with aerospace, I think it's important to now look at the manufacturing side and technology in that area as well going forward. So, again, one of the main objectives out of that plan was business attraction. So working with the airport, we have proposed the Falcon Tech Center concept, which you see up here as well. This is a 60-acre site, city-owned property, airport-owned property, just west of the airport on Greenfield. This really is done in conjunction, not just with the strategic plan that I just spoke about, but back in 2013, we developed a healthcare and life sciences recruitment plan that really now meshes both of these together going forward. So again, 63 acres promotes Mesa as a technology hub, high-quality, knowledge-based jobs, and we're trying to leverage our city resources, obviously, and the big thing, it offers an opportunity for some public-private partnerships going forward. So you may ask, why Falcon Field for this? Why, you know, in this area in general? And there's some key pieces of this, and you start with infrastructure. We have a tremendous amount of infrastructure that's already in place there, water, sewer, gas. But, for example, there's already in the ground on the east side of Greenfield 14 two-inch conduits for fiber purposes. Again, that makes a great opportunity for us to leverage. Location. When we looked at the whole area, we found that if all the general aviation airports in the region, what's the proximity to Sky Harbor? This by far is the closest. The intersection of 202 and 101 is a very big destination for the development community. You're 10 minutes from this location. So again, location, location, location. And the other thing, this will allow us to do very careful planning It allows us to then dictate some quality that's really necessary in that area, I think, going forward, and then allow us to target some specific companies that fit here very well. Go ahead, Corrine. So this is an example of a conceptual park layout. This is really allow us to capture some various sizes of businesses, from the big companies to the smaller, again, medical technology, life sciences sector. It's really a growth sector for us, and we're really trying to create an opportunity here. Healthcare is the largest private sector employer in the U.S. with 3.2 million new jobs expected over the next 10 years. In addition, Arizona's life science industry has grown by 45% over the last 10 years compared to 12% nationally. So you can see why we're starting to zoom in there a little bit. That recruitment plan we talked about as well really identified some gaps in the region and allowing us to develop technology facilities in these locations. I think it really allows us to go after the smaller companies that are leaving the region and the larger companies are actually shipping work out. This will create an opportunity for some of them to actually stay put and give them some different opportunities that don't exist in the Valley today. We're home to 25 medical device related companies today and over 7,800 jobs in the healthcare and life sciences industry. Again, you can see why the focus and the growth and the effort that we're putting forth. This would be unique. This doesn't exist in the Valley. And I think when you look across the country, we're looking for different models. And this would be something that is a little unique when you focus on medical technology or technology in general. It creates a unique opportunity for us. Last one. This is a concept of the entryway at the monument, trying to incorporate the orange groves into this, still keep with some of the demands of the companies that are out there. But this would be the entrance, and it elevates our image as, I think, a premier location for these tech companies going forward. Let me get into next steps. We are in the process of, in a zoning case, I guess is the best way to put it, John, and we're not looking to change the zoning on this parcel, but we are looking to change some of the stipulations. So we are going through together an effort to everything from citizen participation plan to the public process and really getting out some of the key attributes that are necessary and putting the proper stipulations in place on this zoning. So that is actually starting to roll out. You'll see that going forward in the next several months as well. We have developed some marketing material. Corrine referred to the two staff that are out recruiting today. They have with them brochures, some information about the site. We have developed a microsite on the web as well, and the trade shows we already mentioned. Mr. Brady has warned me not to get out too far ahead of ourselves and to get the zoning in place. One of the big long lead times for this is actually an environmental assessment, and that is a requirement of FAA, which is Corrine's territory.
Yes, it is. Because this land was originally purchased with the assistance of some state grant funding from the aviation division at the state, the FAA required that this property be put on what is called the airport layout plan, which is generally, it's a big map of what the airport includes. And so the citrus groves that we're talking about here is included on the airport layout plan. In order for the city to fully implement this program, the FAA has advised us that we will need to update our airport layout plan to reflect this specific type of development. And in order to do that, they are requiring that we conduct an environmental assessment on that land. So we're already, we've already engaged a consultant to assist us with doing that. And once that EA is completed, then the airport layout plan will be updated, submitted to the FAA, and hopefully approved as quickly as possible.
Quick question. A lot of times when we talk about environmental assessments, we're talking about looking for sources of contamination. I'm assuming that's not the focus here. The environment meaning the conflict between having buildings constructed on the edge of runways.
Well, the thing that they're going to be focusing on that they've indicated are really three things. One is going to be archaeological. Mm-hmm. See if there's anything there that needs to be documented. Secondly, they want to make sure that we look at any stormwater detention or retention issues. And third, they want us to take a look at what impact the removal of some of those trees may have on any of the wildlife that may be residing or nesting in that area.
Okay. Look forward to hearing the results of that.
We do too.
So, what is the timing then? If we're is this a year before we'll get the
so
results?
Yeah. So when we say moving quickly and FAA in the same sentence, it's
right.
we really want to make sure the council knows we're moving forward and we're pursuing this, and we'll move as fast as we can. But oftentimes that means we wait for approvals, but we're hiring the consultants to get the work submitted and make the applications in so that we can bring this back to the council as soon as possible. But we're also trying to time it so we're also doing the outreach with the surrounding neighborhoods. You'll notice the way we've tried to situate this development too, that we'll have the buffer between the back of the property, the west edge, and the canal, but also that area to the west of the property is low density development. We've tried to avoid backing up to any other residential units. So we're trying to avoid any conflicts, but also we'll have another buffer behind or to the east of the canal, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So we're trying to, but we also want to make sure the residents understand what we're doing. But so it's all multiple steps, kind of parallel paths with the FAA, as well as working with the surrounding neighborhoods, working with Councilor Luna. We've been talking about the outreach program that we put in place.
Thank you. Mr. Richards.
Is the FAA the lead agency on the EA?
In terms of what they're requiring?
Right. Are they, are they the lead agency to conduct the environmental assessment?
No.
And then they hire a third party contractor to do it, but usually if it's a federal required environmental assessment, there's a lead agency, and I just not sure who
actually,
that is.
Actually, they have charged the city with conducting the EA, and so we have hired a consultant who is not only very well versed in environmental assessments, but also really focuses a lot on airport planning.
Okay.
To conduct the EA. They will prepare the report, submit it to us as the city for review, and then we will send it off to the FAA for their review.
Is there any required public hearings or scoping?
Yes, they will require some public meetings to receive input from the community.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Finter.
And so folks know that we're not trying to get rid of thriving citrus and things. That those orchards are so old, old, that they're deteriorating.
They are.
And correct me if I'm wrong, we went from having a contractor that would pay us to taking care of it and harvesting to now we're paying them keep them from dying in mass. So that's what happens in, you know, North Mesa. These old orchards have a lifespan, and so I hope people will understand that as the discussion comes up. So I just,
Great. Yes, Mr.
You know, this I'm excited about this project. I'm hoping that we can get it off the ground. It's part of the visioning committee that then Mayor Alex Venter put together. So this is real exciting. I hope we can move it forward and just get these companies to come in Mesa. So thank you so much for your hard work on this project.
Thank you.
It is, I think you're right. It's important to note that this process started a couple of years ago when Mayor Finter initiated the Falcon Field Planning or Visioning Committee. And so it's good to see that we're making progress on really a great part of town. But when Corinne talks about all the economic activity out there, sometimes we forget really how robust it is, because it's such a big area, and you do drive by some undeveloped pieces of property, and you might have the mistaken impression that things aren't hopping out there, when in fact they really are to a large extent. Just yesterday, I was at a ribbon cutting for a great business called Gecko that is a Boeing subcontractor. Hundreds of new jobs tied directly to projects with Boeing. And they just are, you know, they just fit into the landscape of that neighborhood, and nobody really knows they're there. But there's really just a lot of good stuff going on at Falcon. So thank you to both of you for helping us move that forward. Any other questions, Council, on this topic? Thank you very much. Next item is a 1D, hear a presentation and discuss the city's fiscal year 2016-17 financial forecast. Denise, good to have you here.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. This morning, we'd like to take the opportunity to not only talk about the forecast going into 16-17, but also do kind of a quick overview of what's actually included in the forecast and how that forecast gets developed and how we use it here within the city of Mesa. Some of these things we're looking at, a financial forecast, we come to you each year. About this time, about the February-March timeframe, to talk to you about the financial forecast, which is really the sustainability of the services that we provide here in the city of Mesa. This year, it shouldn't really be, some of these numbers would not really be new to you, as this year is the first year that we started our quarterly financial report. And so far this year, we have hit both the first quarter and the second quarter. Second quarter financial report came out just about a month ago. And that would have given you the latest update about how we're doing so far this year, both on the expenses and revenues for our unrestricted funds, which we consider our general fund and our enterprise fund in total. One of the things that multi-year or forecasting does is it lets us look out at multiple years. So what we don't want to do is just be looking at 1 year at a time as we go into the 16-17 budget. We're not looking at just the 16-17 budget, but also the years that follow that. How is the economic conditions looking? What are the needs of the city? Are there growth areas we need to take care of? Is there technology that we can leverage to do our services better, and those types of things. So those are all types of things that go into the financial forecast. One of the things that in our financial policies that we try to adhere to is making sure that we're recognizing what are ongoing revenues versus one-time revenues, and what are our ongoing needs or expenses versus our one-time needs or expenses, and how can we correlate those two together. When we talk about revenue forecasting, for the revenue forecasting, the city subscribes to a service it comes out of the U of A, that actually, it's a forecasting service. And what it is they don't forecast for us, but it gives us access to actually the raw data that the economists use. So we're looking at the same data that the economists use when they're looking at the economy. We bring it in-house. We have a statistical package here that our staff use to actually take that and look at what they're predicting long-term and short-term, but then also see how that correlates to what economic indicators are best for Mesa. So they look at it for the whole state of Arizona, but we actually then take it and say, well, which ones actually correlate to how Mesa's doing in the past and how that might help us predict how Mesa's going to do in the future. And so we take a look at that in-house. And then we also apply those things that we know within our community. Are there economic development sites that we're working on? Do we have more jobs coming in? What are our building permits or our housing starts looking at for Mesa specific versus Arizona in general, which is what the economy looks at? So each year we talk about, our general governmental revenues. And we have three main sources that we talk about each year. And those are the city sales tax that we talk about a lot, usually gets the highest attention. And that's our local sales tax. The other one we don't want to forget about is our state shared revenues and some changes that have actually happened that will be affecting us of this upcoming year. And then our enterprise transfer from the enterprise fund into the general fund. Those are the utility rates that we pay there. So you can kind of see the relation to that going forward. Okay. One of the things that we don't have in here that I will mention as we go off, we do have show our forecast going into the forecast of 18-19. We are working with all the main, economy opinions that are out there. There is some There is some word that at some point we are going to see a slight decline. Everyone's right now arguing on when that decline is going to come. Don't think it's going to be big at this point, but right now we'll keep that on the horizon, and we'll be continuing to talk with them about what they're seeing in the economy and what we're seeing here in the city of Mesa. Again, we're not forecasting anything drastic. We just want to make sure everyone's aware we are coming out of the recession, but it is an economic cycle like any other economic cycle, and at some point there will be a slight turn down and then back again. So we do not have any of that in here, but we're watching that. Okay. So when we look at how we've done, excuse me, looking back, we always want to kind of look back and look forward all at the same time. Where have we been and where are we going? So when we look at it coming across, you can see if you kind of go to the bottom line, the impact on our general governmental revenues. This is our general fund and our quality of life. We kind of put those together because they're all funding public safety and all the other services that we do. And you can see kind of how we're trending over time. In 14-15, we did see an upswing in the 5.5% range. For 15-16, right now, we're projecting about 2.2 overall. But if you go to that top line, you can see that our local sales tax is coming in stronger than we had originally anticipated for 15-16. We're going to be watching that going into the second half of the year. Last year, about this time, is when the sales tax started to pick up. So that's why you're seeing us being a little bit conservative going out through the end of the year, because the first half of this year was an increase over the first half of last year, but the second half of last year is where we saw the uptick. So the question is, are we going to continue to be year over year higher than we were last spring? So we think we'll be higher than we projected. The question is how high? And we'll keep looking at that. One of the things I do want to point out on this slide is our state shared revenues. They look a little low when you're looking at our 16-17 forecast. And the reason for that is there is a formula change with the state. State shared revenues are based on population. And we had 7 cities in the state who did a mid-decade census. And what that did is that changed the population figures. For the city of Mesa, that accounts for about $1.7 million in our general fund revenues that would have been there in 16-17 that will not be there due to the formula change. It's just under about $500,000 in our highway user revenue fund, which affects only our transportation department. So in here. So if those had trended on a normal economic trend, the state sales tax would be 3.3% in growth. The urban revenue sharing, which is income tax, would be a 9.2% growth, and the vehicle license tax would have been a 5.5% growth. So what you're seeing here is the impact to Mesa from 1 year to the next year.
So do you think that'll reset when we get to the decade, the census in 5 years then?
So the legislation, and I don't know if it's been approved yet, but the legislation to deal with this going forward is to now, instead of doing a recalculation every 10 years, is to do it annually.
Oh.
So instead of having these large swings in the kind of resetting of the formula, it'll be done on an annual basis. Now, that's after next year. So
correct.
It's
17-18 would be the first time we would
so yeah, that. But it instead that is the legislation that the league came together to not oppose the 7 cities moving forward with the mid-decade census.
Are they going to base that on the American Community Survey then? How are they going to base those numbers?
So they there's the I think it's the census number.
The American Community Survey is the annual.
It's the annual number that's given. I think you have a choice. I think there's two options. Mr. Butler can probably answer that question, but I know there is a
option. Starbucks and coffee. I don't see.
Hopefully, he's down trying to get this legislation passed. But there is a specific reference to an annual census, and I don't recall the top of my head what it's called.
All right, sorry. Thank you.
That's good.
On that topic, I do have a quick question. So there were these handful of cities that opted for the mid-decade census update. And I think that the deal that was struck with them is that going forward, we're going to do it annually so that we're not this feast and famine thing.
Right, there you go.
It's just more accurately every year we are all updated, so we have a real honest picture of where we are relative to the other communities in the state. But were we updated as well? I mean,
that's
the problem.
That's the difference. That's they were the only ones that got the new numbers updated, and so that's what kept probably the that's what's helping creating the differential. Yeah. Then after in the 17-18, then everybody will be doing it on the annual basis. So hopefully that'll get us trued up faster at that point.
I think the good news is that Mesa continues to grow. I mean, we're not growing at the breakneck pace of maybe some of our far west neighbors or cities that are very small and that are growing dramatically. But look at Eastmark, look at Lehigh Crossing. We're still going to continue to grow. So I would presume next year when this new legislation and formula is in place, we won't see a decrease. We might be kind of in a break-even proposition, or maybe even
we can hold our.
We might hold. It'll be because even though the city of Mesa is growing, it's the speed at which we grow compared to all of the other cities in Arizona. Yeah. Yeah. So at this point right now, the ones who went through the mid-decade census have been able to count the growth that they've had in the last 5 years. Yeah. And basically our growth is not in those population
numbers. As a percentage,
right.
So our numbers can be impressive, but as a percentage, because we're so large, it doesn't have it. But again, the other good news is, though, that the pie of which you're dividing up has gotten larger also. So that kind of offsets some of that. If you have a smaller percentage of the pie, but your pie is larger, then it kind of helps offset some of those impacts also.
So we took a small hit this year, but I think going forward, if this legislation that Mr. Butler is hopefully working on this morning passes, then we'll maintain our fair relative position.
Right, I think that's
in comparison
that's
to the other cities. Okay, thank you.
That's what we're hoping to do.
Please proceed.
Okay. As we look into those, so these are our three main revenues just going into, how does it look for going into 16-17? And again, as we take those economic indicators and we try to look at, again, not just in 16-17, but where we will be the next year after that and the year after that to make sure that we're not just balanced in 1 year, but sustainable over multiple years. And so if you take a look at the state shared revenues, you can see that the volatility is really in the urban revenue sharing. And again, urban revenue sharing is income tax. So it's a state income tax. The city of Mesa receives a portion of that state income tax. So as the income tax, as the salaries and the wages of the workers in the state of Arizona vary, as does the income tax. Income tax is a two-year lag. So when we receive it into the city of Mesa, it's a two-year lag. So it's the salaries that were earned 2 years ago are what we'd be receiving in the upcoming year. So you can see that that's actually a known number for 16-17. That is not a forecasted number. The rest of them are forecasted. 16-17 urban revenue sharing is a known number. It is a kind of a dramatic increase going into 16-17. And when we go back and look at the data and we work with the state, what we're seeing is that there was a lot of capital gains tax that's included in this particular year of income tax. And so when we're going through the forecast, you can see how we've kind of got it dipping down a little bit the second year, because we don't assume that that is a sustainable level from year to year. We think that that is a slight bump. And you can see when we went back on that previous slide, you can see from year to year how it varies, up 8.6% and then back down and keeping level and then up again and so forth. So we've included that in the forecast going forward to make sure that we're not counting on what may turn out to be one-time revenues to sustain our ongoing programs.
Is there anything included in the urban revenue sharing other than state income tax?
No, just the state income tax.
That's the only thing. And there is some discussion in the upper echelons of state government of what some people have a goal of eliminating the state income tax. And if that were to happen, the city of Mesa would lose about $52 million a year.
Correct. Our 16-17 forecast for that one is $57 million is our forecast. That's not a forecast. That's our actual known number for 16-17. Going forward, it will be a little bit less on an ongoing basis. But yes, we're looking at about $50 million. And this is both corporate and personal. It's all income tax is included in that. As we look at local sales tax, what we do is we take our local sales tax and we break it into the different types or categories of sales tax so that we can see and trend how different areas of the economy are doing. The one that's the highest is going to be our retail sales tax. That's always going to be the highest. It's the ones that we look at on a monthly basis. And if you can see where we are, where we're kind of projecting where we think we're going to end for 15-16, if you take a look back in history, you can see that dollar for dollar, we're back to where we were in 2007-08. So it's taken us about 8 years through the recession to get back to a dollar for dollar where we were in 2007-08. Now, that's not the value of the dollar, but a dollar for dollar, the same amount of money is walking in the door today that was walking in the door in 2007-08. and it's 8 years later. If we look at some of the other areas of the lines, you can see our contracting, that's that green line there at the bottom, and you can see that dip that happened during the recession. And while it has recovered, it has not recovered back to that 07-08 year. It's kind of plateaued around the $10 million mark there. You can see we've got quite a few that kind of hit around that mark. So those are the things that we look at going forward. Okay. Were there any questions on the revenue side? Because I'm going to move into the expense side.
Mayor and Council, I think it's important, and we'll cover this a little bit later, but what's important to understand as you understand revenues is the rate of growth that's anticipated going out into the future is pretty modest. But that becomes the governor of the modifier, if you would, of expenses also, because your rate of growth of revenues will dictate really your capacity to grow your expenses. So that's an important, those slopes are very important too as we look out into the future, and we'll talk about that here in a little bit.
Not to be a doom and gloom guy as well and talking about the legislature, but the $20 million number here related to rentals, there is an effort at the legislature this past session that we've been fighting to eliminate a city's ability to collect a sales tax on rentals. So there's another $20 million that really is in play politically.
And that particular for the rentals, it is differentiate between commercial and residential rentals in there. The legislation that's been proposed the last couple of years that hasn't gone through has been on the residential rentals, and that's about $10 million of that line item.
Thank you. So cause for concern. That we need to be vigilant in talking to our legislators and help them understand how important that is to our city budget.
On the expenditure side, when we take a look at how do we actually forecast our expenses going forward, there are a few different areas of expenses. Not all expenses are equal. We take a look at our personal services. Personal services are our positions, our actual city employees, and take a look at the various factors that go into those, like pension rates, what we've talked about quite a bit over the last couple of years, medical premiums and medical costs, salary movements, those types of things are involved in that. When we look at our other services or commodities that we call them, those are going to be your non-position costs, but that can also include temp services. So if we're using temp services to augment our workforce for our peaks and valleys of our workload, those would actually be in our other services category, as well as contracts. Now, when we're forecasting, if we're looking at very large contracts, like our software maintenance contracts, those type of things, we look at those individually. And then the smaller ones is usually consumer cost index is what's applied to those when we're doing forecasting. So we're using the economy to kind of forecast the smaller items. We break the larger ones out and do those individually. Capital is another major component in forecasting. We use that in our capital improvement program. So most of those are going to be construction contracts. While we do most of our construction contracts with bond, selling bonds and bond authorization, we do have other local street sales tax money that we use for them, as well as some cash, some grants, those types of things that come through the capital as well. On the non-construction side, our largest item is vehicles and vehicle replacement would be our capital items that we look at there. So what we have included in our expenditure forecast at this time is we took a look at our public safety retirement contribution. So this is not necessarily the rate itself, but the contribution for the city contributing to the public safety pension. And we've input in about 6% increase in contribution per year, year over year through the forecast period. So again, this is not the rate itself, but the contribution, which can do an increase of the rate, but also just an increase in salaries. It has to follow the pension, follows the rates. Now, what we have looked at, if you recall from last year, there was the increase in the rates themselves, and we chose to do a two-phase phase-in of those new rates because we were allowed to phase it in over 3 years. The city chose to do 2 years. We did $5 million impact. It was in our 15-16 budget this year. The other $3 million will be impacting the 16-17 budget, so that is an increase of $3 million. The total contribution increase is going up about $4 million. Three of that is due to the rate increase. $1 million is just due to overall salaries going up.
And Candace, we should mention that that's not just a one-time increase. That's a
ongoing
increase that we've had to absorb inside the budget.
Right. So that's a new level. It's a new level of contribution that will then continue. That then becomes our new base. So if there are any increased rates going forward, you're off of that new base coming up. And there is one pending court case still that we're watching, and it's the Hall case. And excuse me. Once that goes through, we have a potential impact of the actual rate going up 6% based on the outcome of that court case. That is not included in our forecast. We don't do pending legislation or pending court cases in the forecast. What we do is just put them on a watch to make sure that we understand what the impacts are and what the risks are with those.
How with this, the previous slide and this slide, are we factoring in retirements and workforce planning? You know, because I know the baby boomers had a large entry into the workforce back when they started in the workforce, and I've talked to some police and fire folks, and they have a lot of people that are poised to start retiring. So how do we factor that into our planning and how salaries adjust and all that works out?
Yeah, Mayor, Councilor Richens, we do that. We look at the five-year plan. They try to give us their anticipated retirements and eligible retirements. And Candace, maybe you can speak specifically on the police side, because we have expended a tremendous amount of resources to anticipate those departures and overhires. Do you want to talk about how you've done that?
That's correct. In the last over the last couple of years, we started working with the police. And the fact that they always had vacancies. They always had police officer positions that just seemed to be always vacant all the time. And we wanted to solve that for them because it was increasing their overtime and that sort of thing. And so last year in 14-15, we actually started a very aggressive recruiting process where we let them come in and do a lot of what we call overhires. So there's not positions in their particular budget, so you won't see them as an FTE or a position in their department. They are basically recruit positions. They're allowed to come in. And the goal is that we get them ramped up so that they always have all of their funded positions or approved positions filled. And then somebody in the wings, basically ready to go. It takes them a full year of training before they can actually take a call, start doing calls on their own, meaning that we're still doing overtime. So while they're in training, we still are having to do overtime to kind of backfill all of those positions. So we took a stronger recruiting, larger recruiting classes, more recruiting classes last year. We have quite a few in the training mode right now. Last year, this year right now, in our quarterly report, if you read over the law enforcement, you saw that we were projecting them to be over budget by the end of this year, and that's that still because we're doing that intensive recruiting period and they're still in training. So we're hoping that that's going to put more into the flow in the end so that we know we've had a lot of drops. What's one thing that is good about the drop program is that it does give us a little bit better planning tool. So we know in the drop program, we know when they have to go. They could go earlier. But we know at a certain point that those particular employees will be leaving the city, and we can plan a little bit better, and that lets us do our recruiting a little bit better.
So the overhires are what we use to anticipate and plan for those retirements in the future.
And I'm assuming that we do that throughout city departments, too. You know, we look at how retirements are impending, and we make sure institutional knowledge gets transferred. Well, I know so you've done a really good job, Chris.
Right, so we do that more through what we call succession planning.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Where we do a lot of job rotations and giving individuals opportunities to kind of move up maybe a slot or two and have an opportunity to take on an assignment above where they're assigned today so they get that experience as we anticipate retirements in the future. Okay. We do rotations in different departments. So, yeah, we're working on that throughout the city.
Okay. I just wanted to kind of... Right. Make sure we talked about that a little bit, because yep. The people planning is an important part. I mean,
we're
nothing without our amazing employees doing the things that they do. So thank you.
And the police department is not the only area that we use the overhires in. Anywhere where there's that long lead time in training new personnel coming in, we take a look at that. That would be in our customer service area for utilities, also in our 911 area. Those types of areas where there's that long lead time of training, we take a look at that to make sure that they're not going without without people. And we build that in.
It's probably good to talk just a little bit about the PSPRS legislation that just passed as well, because there is a public vote tied to that. And so it's probably a good opportunity for us to let the public and just confirm with city staff what the status of that is. I notice on your slide that the Arizona State retirement increase is less than 1% a year. So the regular state or city employee pension plan is just fine. It's fully funded.
Based
Well, it's not, not fully funded, but it's not...
Much higher funding, yeah. It's much better shape.
Right. As opposed to PSPRS, the Public Safety Pension and Retirement. There was legislation just signed by the governor. There's a vote, as I think everyone knows, Prop 123, having to do with the education funding issue, is going to be on the ballot in May. There'll be a lot of campaigning about that. What people also need to know, there's a second question on the ballot, and that has to do with the PSPRS reform that was just signed. It's important that they vote. Well, I'll campaign now. As a politician, it's okay for me to say I'm lobbying for people to vote for that, because the current system that we're under without this reform, back in 2010, the city's contribution to the PSPRS was about $14 million, is my recollection.
Next, I would have to look that up. I don't want to confirm, but yes.
The numbers that I was handed when I was testifying at the legislature was that it was about $14 million. Next year, it'll be in the 40s of millions, $41, $42 million. So that is, you can see the dramatic increase and the dramatic impact that has on a budget our size. For that to continue going forward, it's just not sustainable. So this legislation that was just passed and the voter approval of that in May is essential for us to fix this broken PSPRS system.
So, Mayor, there's two parts that were adopted by the legislature. I'm going to let Candace get into the details. So there is... this part you're talking about that affects going forward and how it affects kind of the COLA, if you would, for retirees. That's what is required or is being up for the election. But there was another part of the legislation that was signed that created a different, an alternative pension system. You want to talk about that?
That's a little bit right. There is a separation of that. One is to actually what we would do with the existing employees that are in the pension system today. And that's usually what the court cases are revolving around. It's the modifications that they attempted to make before. The court cases are actually, they're combating and saying that you can't do that on existing employees. And so that's part of it. That's part of what that election is that changing kind of a benefit for those existing employees. And then the other side of that is what do we do with the new employees? And do we keep putting new employees into the same program, or do we come up with a different pension program or benefits or whatever it is to go with new employees? So there's a kind of a separation with the people who are already in the program today and the benefits surrounding them being in that pension program and new employees that haven't been hired yet. And that's kind of the separation between the two.
Mayor, just to make a point on your talking about the dramatic increase, I mean, just in front of us in the last 2 years, we added 5 million plus, I forget how much more we added last year, over 5 million last year, and we'll be adding, as we're telling you today, 4 million again this next year. So just over the last 2 years, it's been nearly, it's probably closer to $10 million just in 2 years we've added in cost to the pension system.
Right. And that's not any additional personnel.
Yeah,
that's our personnel. Existing personnel.
Now, the good news is this legislation is important. It will provide some relief, but it will be future relief, really. The increases that we're sharing with you today will not be materially impacted, if at all, by those changes. But it's good. Something needed to be done. So as new in the future, for sure, we know that as new officers, sworn officers are brought into the system, they will be, if they're under a new system, then that obviously over some period of time, when they're ready to retire, that will that will help help us out. So,
yes, there's a new tier three for the new employees. That's
right.
Not, frankly, quite as generous. It doesn't have the pension spiking opportunity, and it has a more of an equal contribution between employer and employee going into the system. And that's for the future employees. But like you say, going back and address, we still have this, the city of Mesa has a $400 million unfunded liability for our PSPRS. That's the biggest debt that we have as a community. So we will be working on paying that down over the next couple of decades. But going forward, but the good news is that we get the opportunity to change the system. Kudos to the public safety retirement or the public safety unions that were part of this process. kudos to the legislature. I think they did just a really great job of bringing all the stakeholders together and working out a compromise that really everyone has bought off on. So I think it's just important now that we let the public know that for this plan to work, we still need voter approval of it in May. Well, thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hijack your presentation.
That's okay. That's good.
Keep going.
It's a very important topic, and it's as you can see, it's a huge impact to the city of Mesa and our ability to grow services when the cost of our existing services continue to rise. As we go through, as you mentioned, that our ASRS, our Arizona State Retirement System, we're not seeing any huge fluctuations there, so that would just be kind of status quo as we go from one year to the next year. One of the things we do want to kind of mention, though, is our medical premiums. One thing that we have seen over the last, it's really calendar year of 2015, but that's actually kind of hitting our 14-15 and 15-16 fiscal years. We are seeing a large increase in cost of claims for medical services. And so as we look forward and we look at our premiums going forward, we're anticipating in the forecast that the city's portion of the contribution to that Employee Benefit Trust Fund would go up 8% in calendar year 2016. So that would be half of the next fiscal year. And then another 8% in 2017 calendar year. And right now we've got the 5% in the forecast for calendar years after that. We'll have to take a look and see where we're at. But we've seen those claims going up dramatically in this last year, so we'll have to make some modifications there. The other thing that we have is we do have included in the system is also anything revolving around some memorandums of understanding with our public safety associations. We did have a three-year. Each year had an increase in the salary to get them up to a market rate after the end of 3 years. So this is the third year of 3 years is included in that forecast, as well as ongoing impacts to the salary for the civilian side. As well, modifications were made last year that still have a few impacts in this going into 16-17, and those have been included in the forecast as well. We do want to bring up one more thing since we are talking about state legislation. Transaction privilege tax, that is an ongoing factor. We have included it, even though that the Department of Revenue has not taken over the activities that they were scheduled to take over this last year. We are paying the ongoing amount of $760,000. It is based on population, so that was modified with the mid-decade census as well. So we are paying based on population for the services provided by the Department of Revenue, even though the Department of Revenue has not taken over some of those sales tax services yet. Those are included in the forecast. We also paid this year in 15-16 a one-time payment of $334,000. That was our contribution to the revision of their computer system so that they could handle our returns. It was adopted as a one-time payment, although we are hearing that it may be more than one time and we may see it again next year. So we're not sure. Again, there's no official word, but we have included it in our forecast to make sure that we have the capacity if we are asked to make an additional one-time payment, as they have not finished that system configuration.
As long as we're on the topic of passing out congratulations and condemnations to the legislature, here's one that I can't help but complain a little bit about. A couple of years ago, the legislature took away the ability of the cities to collect transaction privileges tax. The Department of Revenue has totally failed in taking that task over, but as you point out, we are still paying them millions of dollars to do what they're not doing. Because they've never been able to figure out how to get this job done. So this is not a shining success of the Arizona legislature. It'll be hopefully in the next year or so we'll see the Department of Revenue come up to speed and be able to do what we are paying them to do. And it won't be the financial disaster that some of us are worried about. Sorry, we just said the legislature did a good job a moment ago, so I had to give them equal time. I'm sorry. Please continue.
Sure. Some of the things that we do want to make sure that you're aware of that are not included in our expenditure forecast, so things that are not included in there, are some of our life cycle items. And you've heard me talk about that over the last couple of years, of how we really need to take a look at our life cycle plans. Life cycle, when we consider life cycle, those are things, they're not in the capital improvement program. They're not construction projects. But they're large ticket items or things that we need to replace every 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. There's large tickets, so they didn't really fit into some department's operational budget. So some examples of those in the fire, and like in the fire department, are their breathing apparatus that we replace all at one time, so they all have the same equipment all at the same time. That's a large ticket item that it doesn't usually fall within the fire department's budget. It's something that we kind of plan for citywide, as well as things like in the radios for the police department. Again, it's cycling through all of those radio replacements because there's so many of those types of things. The other items that fall in there are vehicle replacement programs. So our vehicles, the departments do not fund the replacement of their vehicles. That's funded at a citywide level where we look at the replacements that need to happen in a particular year, prioritize which ones need to happen first based on the funding that's available. And so we do that kind of as a central location. For our vehicle replacement program, we do have $2.5 million, excuse me, that we set aside each year for vehicle replacements. In the past, we found that the vehicles on the replacement list that qualify have been had the amount has been greater than what we've had in an annual basis for those. Information technology software upgrades are not included in the forecast at all. It is one of the things that we look at continuously. Our IT staff and our information technology department takes a look at that. They watch the applications. They look for critical mass when it's either not going to be supported or it's no longer functionally working because it doesn't work or integrate with some of the other software that's already been upgraded in the city. So they take a look at that. They have detailed analysis on exactly which ones are coming up so that we can try to plan for that. Unfortunately, we just have not had the ability to put in an ongoing source like we do with the vehicle replacement program. We haven't had that ability to put in kind of that ongoing annual set aside. So what usually happens for that is we're looking for realized savings or items that we don't need to do. And an example that we've had in the past is for our CAD upgrade that we just went through was a software upgrade. It's a software application upgrade. So it was not funded in our forecast. And we were able to find some funding for that by we discontinued for 1 year our Microsoft Enterprise license. That's kind of our maintenance of all of the Microsoft licensing for the year as we started moving off of the mainframe and we started moving more to the cloud environment and that type of a thing. We were able to take a 1 year reprieve from that. Which was about $1 million, and that's what we needed for the CAD upgrade. And so that's how kind of that works together and how we work with those. But it is not in the forecast, so as we're looking at the trend line for expenditures, their application software upgrades are not in there. So I want to make sure you understand that. And the other thing is our facility maintenance. We do set aside $3 million a year for the facility maintenance area to contribute to various repairs and remodels that need to be done on the various buildings. And that is, again, the identified needs that they've had over time are usually greater than what we've set aside in any given year. So we're usually reacting. If there's a large ticket item that needs to be replaced, that's usually more of a reactive mode for us on finding the funding. We do get it done, but it's just more of a reactive on finding the funding. Program that we do not include in the forecast as we look forward is we have not put anything in for the continuation of the fire department's community medical units. That is a grant, if you recall, we are in about the middle of the grant, getting on the other side of the middle of the grant. It does expire in August of 2017. We will be working with the fire department to find out. That is about $4 million a year is the grant, but we've been working with them on what that net would be if we try to anticipate what we would be reimbursed from insurance companies and private carriers, that ability to kind of bill back. If you recall, we're not billing today. We're kind of faux billing. They're going through and trying to determine what would have been received going through those. We're not actually receiving revenues today. So it would be the data that we would need to collect to see what we would receive in the future and how could we cover those ongoing costs. But that grant is about $4 million a year. Additional costs with the location down at Baseline and Country Club, we have put into our capital improvement program the actual dispatch center and emergency operations center, the remodeling and so forth, but that is a larger campus, larger location, and at this point, they're still working, staff is still working on the master plan and that type of a thing, so it has not been included in the capital improvement program or in any kind of operational costs of operating any of the other buildings at that location at this time. And then the forecast does not call for any new personnel going through that, so we don't assume growth, we don't assume new officers, we don't assume new firefighters. That would include capital improvement program right now. The capital improvement program will show one new fire station over this kind of 5-year time period that we look at. At this time, we do not have the operating costs of that fire station in the forecast. So that would be an additional cost. When that came on board, we'd have to make sure we had ongoing funding to continue that out. We do have some money set aside that we have for some apparatus out in the Eastmark area that we received from DMB, but the actual ongoing portion of the personnel itself are not included in the forecast at this time.
It seems like it would be good to point out that that's not good. Right. These are all real public safety needs, and we're acknowledging up front we're not budgeting for some public safety things that we know we're going to need. So that's obviously
we're just
problem
saying
we're
in our forecast
about.
Model, they're not included. Now, as we move along in the budget discussions, you may see, you know, there'll probably be requests for some of this, and we're just going to figure, you know, it may be, we may have to cut something to do something more, or to do something on this list, but we're trying to be very careful. Sometimes it's not just as important to know what's in the forecast, but what didn't get included. Now, we're going through the meetings with the departments now. Obviously, a lot of these issues are being discussed, and we'll have to see if there's any way to address some of these in the next budget, but it's not in the forecast. So we just want to say that the snapshot that we're giving you today of revenues and expenditures, it doesn't include these items. Now, when we come back with a budget and go through the budget discussions, yeah, we'll be having to work through some of those issues again.
Yes, Mr. Finner.
Estimated operating costs for annually for a fire station, or maybe this Eastmark station that we're looking at. What are we guessing or thinking?
Usually you're about $1.5 million, 1.5 to 1.7, depending on the location, number of units there. But we usually, when we're looking at a fire station, the capital improvement program, we're looking at a staffing of 13 is usually what we add to the department in total in order to staff that particular department. That includes also operations, utilities, landscaping, contracts, custodial. I mean, everything that kind of goes along with the fire station. And also just, Mayor and Council, just to be clear, too, when we say that it's not in the forecast, that doesn't mean that we don't have a plan and that we're not trying to work toward it. It just means that at the end of the day, when we say, here's how the revenue increases, as Mr. Brady talked about, our revenue are increasing at this rate, and we say our expenses are increasing at this rate. We just want to make sure that you understand when we say that our expenses are increasing at this rate, we mean what we have today, that we haven't anticipated for the growth. We've anticipated, but we don't have a funding source, so we haven't put it into the model at this point. But we have a plan, and it's in the capital improvement program. We have life cycle plans. We've identified all the needs. It's a matter of identifying the funding.
But your statement's still correct. It's not good.
Right. I agree. I'm not being critical of staff. You're coming to us and saying, here's a problem.
Right.
We're not including this in our forecast.
Right.
And I think it's incumbent. Our problem as a council is we need to realize the reality is that there will be needs for growth in public safety. And so we're going to, during the budgeting process, we're going to have to reconcile that.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Thank you.
So some of this we've kind of already covered of. Basically, when we're looking at one of the things I want to point out on our personal services, which are position budgeting, one of the things that when we budget as though that position will be filled the entire year, and it's fully loaded costs. It was benefits, taxes, pension, everything like that when we budget. There are a couple of things that we don't actually budget for when we go into the 16-17 fiscal year, and you'll see that. And is that the payout type of thing. So when somebody leaves the city, they get to pay out all of their vacation they've accrued, those types of things. We do a vacation buyback at the end of the calendar year, so usually in January. That's an expense to the departments. We don't add those types of things, or someone retires, they get to actually cash out 50% of their sick time and 100% of their vacation time. So those are kind of some big bumps that the departments experience, but they experience them every year. And so how we handle that is we know they're going to have vacancies. We know they're not going to have every position filled and every day. And so their vacancy savings from those positions are actually applied to those payouts. So so when you see the vacation, you say we only have all these positions, but at the end of the day, but we had all these payouts, why didn't you budget for those? Because that's what we're counting on. We're counting on that the positions won't be filled the whole year. And so far each year, the departments have been able to cover all of those payouts with their vacancy savings. The other thing we use vacancy savings on are two different areas. Is one is overtime costs might go up. So their overtime budget might be higher, or overtime expenses might be higher than budget, because their straight expenses are lower than budget because they had vacancies. And so it actually makes their overtime go up, and they use those vacancy savings on overtime. Those would be areas that have the 24-hour shifts and the minimum coverage and that type of thing. And then the other area is temp services. So if somebody has some vacancies and they have to bring in some temps while they're trying to do the recruitment, you would see them actually use some of their vacancy savings from the position to cover their temp services, which is actually in the another category, other services. So just things to be aware of there is fluidity through the budget on we're still accomplishing the same goal, we're providing the same service, but it might be straight time, overtime, or temp services that are being taken up to do that. And we talked a little bit about how we do with the various savings that we have, that we try to fund those life cycle items. So again, that's how we kind of circle back to life cycle items. We always have this list of, we know the needs that are out there in the city, in each department and citywide. And we try to look at those and identify how can we fund those for you. So an example that we had this year was within our fire department. They actually had more people that were going to terminate over the next year they could forecast. It was a little bit higher than like an average year that they were going to have. So we needed to put additional folks in the academy, and we also need to put additional folks in paramedic training to kind of replace those paramedics that were going to be going out the door. So we were able to identify that the savings they had in their budget last year, because this was July that we knew this, and so it was we just had just adopted the budget. We were able to verify that they were going to have some savings from the previous year that was going to help us in our reserve balance, and that we were able to go ahead and do those kind of one-time costs of putting extra people through those academies and through that training. So that's kind of the ebb and flow of how we look and try to fund those needs, either unanticipated or life cycle on those. And I think that hits most of these on this one. So that's our operational. So when we talk about our operations and how is that moving forward through time, that's basically what we're talking about. It's that personal services, these other services, commodities. It's us providing those ongoing services. There are other items that actually hit our forecast and hit the general governmental area. And one is the debt service. And we kind of want to draw your attention to this one because it is an item. For 16-17, we do not need a general fund transfer in order to cover our general obligation debt. That's outstanding. We have had to do that in the past. The last time that we had to do that was in 13-14. In the fiscal year 13-14, it was a $5 million transfer that we made from the general fund to our debt service fund in order to cover outstanding debt service costs. But we did not have to do that in the subsequent years, and we don't forecast having to do that going into 16-17. And there's kind of a combination of factors that contribute to that. One, the general fund was not the only source of income to pay that debt. We have a court construction fee fund that's actually helping to pay off some of the debt related to the construction of the new court building. I know we say new court building's been around for a while, but for us, it's the new court building. We're still paying the debt on it. So we have those types of funding areas. And so we've kind of included this graph, and we've already shown you this graph. This is the one we showed when we did the bond refundings and kind of gave you that overview. But really the point of this, to show this graph here, is just to show you that there isn't any general fund transfer in here. It's really what's not here versus what is here. And that we don't have that over the next few years going forward. So when we say that is not included in the forecast, it's included in our planning, and we do not feel that it's needed during the forecast years. Okay. The other one that we have is we have a couple funds that we transfer funds to, from the general fund to augment the funding that they receive within their own area. One is the transit area. So for transit, we do have various revenues that offset the cost for the transit services for the city of Mesa, but the revenues do not completely offset the cost of that particular program. And so in 15-16, we're anticipating that the needs would be about $9.6 million that we would be augmenting that particular program. And then in 16-17, we'd go up about 10.2. Some of that is going to that full 12 months of the light rail through Central Mesa. So in 15-16, it wasn't open the entire year. So the increase between 1 year to the next, some of that is just the annualized cost of that going up. In the forecast, we do include the operational costs of the Gilbert Light Rail extension coming online, and we currently have that in fiscal year 18-19 as a full year cost. So when you're looking at that, that is included in there. Okay. Arts and culture is something that's new, not new to the city, but new to the way we're managing the fund of it. And what we did was we broke it out. This is the first year in fiscal year 15-16. It's the first year that we actually broke it out from the general fund itself. It makes it a little bit easier to see. It's a little bit easier to manage. So when Cindy over in Arts and Cultural Department is looking at her revenues and can she do another show and is it cost effective to do that, it gives her a little bit better management tool to do that. So it's a little bit different. Before, it would have been in the expenses. as just normal expenses of a part of the city, and now you see it as a transfer over into their fund. And so for this year, we're estimating about $9 million transfer into the Arts and Culture Fund, and 16-17 going up a little bit into the 9.8. And so that's just something new. We want to point that out to you.
And so, Candace, this continue, it also helps to highlight the fact that revenues from ticket sales or activities at the, well, all of the
Arts and Culture
Department,
right,
go back into supporting those operations. So sometimes I think they feel, someone suggests that somehow we're sweeping those or using those for other general fund activities. That's not the case. But this way, by pulling it out a little bit, mm-hmm, really helped us to track that and identify what's coming in and what's going out.
Correct.
For those operations, and because they're not necessarily an enterprise, but they're kind of close to a separate business operation, that's why we've decided to make that happen. So
would that be net, that 9 million, or does that take into account all the revenue generation that comes? Because it always goes into that, you know, to the general fund, and they call that the black hole. Not arts, but some people do. And so how does that get allotted?
Yeah, curious. Mayor and Councilmember Fincher, this is the net number. So we have set up a new fund. It's their Arts and Culture Fund. All of the revenues generated by their facilities or their services, if they lease out the facilities, that type of thing, all of those revenues go into the Arts and Culture Fund. This is the transfer. This is what they're short each year. And so this would come from the general fund.
We'll call it the city
contribution to arts.
Our contribution to arts.
For those. So we do want to point that out as some of the, and I'll show you here on the next one. So when we do these changes, and they are for, you know, there are these great changes that will help us manage the business a little bit better, manage the city's revenues a little bit better. But what it does sometimes is it makes it hard for us to compare apples to apples as we start kind of going through fiscal years. When we look at the revenues and we show you fiscal year trends, they're really easy. The revenues haven't changed. The revenue sources haven't changed. How we look at them hasn't changed. But when we look at our expenses over the last few years, we have made some changes. And that's why you'll see kind of on this graph, sometimes it's not just as easy as taking last year's number and this year's number and figuring out what the difference is. What you have to know is that arts and culture was in last year's number and it's not in this year's number of that line and those types of things. So what I've tried to do here, hopefully I've succeeded, and I guess you'll let me know if you have any questions, as I've tried to kind of make an apples to apples comparison of what's happened over the last year and what we foresee is happening next year. And so I've looked at, so we talked about the operational expenditures, so that's not the CIP program, the debt service, the transit that we talked about, but we're talking about personal services and providing those. So those are kind of the bold numbers at the top. And so we look at that percentage growth that we were talking about, because that's what we want to really look at, is how are we growing compared to our revenues, and that's definition of sustainable, right? So if we look at 13-14, our growth on that operating side was about 4.7. percent. Going into 15-16, we're projecting a growth of 5.3, and into 16-17, a growth of 3.6 off of that base going forward. That's kind of that operating. So that's kind of where we're looking. The other ones that we can see, how is transit doing? How is arts and culture doing? And we can look at those individually because they're pulled out of those. If we look at the bottom line overall, because the transit does affect, those transfers do affect that. Overall, the growth in our expenditures is about 2.6. The 5.8 and 3.3. So now if we think back to what that revenue slide said and what our growth was for that, and we put those two together, which I didn't kind of put them together on a slide for you, but our revenues over that same three-year time period was 5.5, 2.2, and 3.1. Our expenses are 2.6, 5.8, and 3.3. So they're kind of different years and so forth, but they're actually very close of what's in there. Now, knowing what we have in the expenditure forecast and what's not included. So right now, we're actually, our expenses are growing very closely to what our revenues are forecasted to grow based on what's in the forecast going forward. And so we take a look at our expenses, and this is kind of a new graph we did this year to kind of show the trend of who's in there. When we talk about those operating expenses, these are the departments. So this actually matches the categories that are on that quarterly report. So when you look at that quarterly report and you see law enforcement, that's the police department and court. Then you see fire, and you see parks and library and so forth, those kind of broad categories. This matches those broad categories. One thing to point out to you on the transit line, and it's in the document as well, but you see a little bit better on the graph, there is that kind of dip going down. And that was last year. That was a one time. What that was an accumulated fund balance And also, we had two reconciliations that happened with Valley Metro in 1 year. We usually have only one. So we ended up with some additional funds that were available that allowed us to only do almost $1 million transfer versus our $9 million transfer. So that is a blip. It's a one-time. And so we know that. And going forward, we forecasted the normal transfer that we'd have on that one. But that kind of gives you a view of who's in that. When we're talking about operational, that top line is law enforcement, which is police department and the court. And then the third line there is then the fire department. So you can see those are our public safety numbers. Okay. So putting it all together, what does that mean? Putting it all together is looking at the financial sustainability, right? So forecast is the actual process of forecasting the revenues and forecasting the expenses. The sustainability portion is actually putting those together to see if the services you're providing are sustainable over time. And that's our goal. Are we able to sustain programs over time? Because we certainly don't want to start a program that we have to stop 2 years later, even though it's successful, just because we don't have funding. And so we take that and we put it all together. This is where those lines are. So we take those kind of trend lines and we pull them all together. Now you know all the different pieces that are in there. So this looks really simple, but you know all the behind the scenes that goes with this. And this is where we are. And so you can see we kind of talked about the slopes of these lines are very similar. So as with what's in the forecast today, the growth of those expenses are matching pretty well the growth in the revenues going forward, okay? But what you can see is that the expense line is still greater than the revenue line, though. This is new revenues. This is not fund balance or reserve balance in here. So this is just going forward. You also see in 17, 18, you see it widens just ever so slightly. It's a little bit hard to see on this scale. That's the Greenfield. The Gilbert Road light rail extension coming on board. You've seen that coming in. It's a net number. We are going to get some fare revenues, but again, the cost will be greater than the revenues coming in. So that's in there, and you can see that going through. So if you wondered what happened to the graph I showed you last year, because this is the graph we looked at last year, and we went through some budget reductions to try to bring that gap and close that gap. We originally talked about it being a two-year process to try to do that. This is where we were last year. And so that kind of gives you some perspective of what we did as a city and the decisions we made and the council made last year and how we were able to really close that gap going forward. And so we're in a much better place today than we were a year ago.
We narrowed the gap.
Yes, we narrowed the gap. We have not closed the gap, but we have narrowed the gap. But I just want to make sure that we're giving the proper attention to it's not easy for the department directors to do this. We know that we've asked them to do this repeatedly. We've asked them to do this year over year. They're faced with increased costs and pension and so forth that they just really have no control over. But when we do ask them to dig down and figure out how we can provide those services more efficiently or better or pick which service is the best one and let's provide that one, they do it every time. And so I do want to give them credit, the directors and their staff, and just do a fabulous job every time we ask them to do this. And this is what we accomplished over this last year. So we originally talked about doing a two-year process, and the second year we would close the gap. You know, first year we cut it in half, and we did that. Second year we closed the gap. What we've done going into the budget cycle this year is we actually had some realized savings from 14-15. There were some, that basically the transit transfer was our big one. So normally we do that transfer. It was scheduled to be about $7 million. We only had to do less than $1,900,000. And so that's one-time savings. What that did is that gave a little bit of a buffer if we kind of use that realized savings to kind of put in our reserves and say, okay, we won't go into, for the 16-17 budget, we have maintained the budget for the departments. We have not asked them to come back with reductions at this time. What we're hoping to do and how we set the budget is we actually take their position costs fully loaded, and so their position budget, their costs will go up. Their people, their position didn't go up, but the costs will go up, and we've covered that at this point. And then we held the rest of their budget at last year's levels. And that's what they're providing now, and that's what they're working on. But what we're asking them to do is to go back in and through innovation, through process review and improvement, through looking at all the different services that they provide and are there maybe more better ones to what's accomplishing their mission or what they're trying to achieve. And we've asked them to actually go in and look through innovative innovations to find the savings. So we're not taking it from their budget for 16-17. We're actually going to have it in their budget. But we're actually going to ask them to look to try to have 2% savings across the board in every department, that 2% savings will get us down to where closer on closing that gap. So the kind of what we've targeted for next year is not identifying all of those issues today, where we have to, they have 2 months to figure it out, and we adopt the budget, and then they have to kind of figure out how to implement it. We're giving them a little bit more time. We still want to come up with about a 2% savings and all in kind of across the board citywide. But we're giving them more time to come up with innovative ideas and innovative ways to do that versus having them go in today.
So, Mayor and Council, we just what we'll anticipate as with the departments is we think there's 2%. Typically, that happens kind of through natural attrition and other activities. But our goal with working with departments, let them kind of figure that out now, as opposed to trying to make a decision today, almost 18 months ahead of when there'll be, or a year ahead of their budget. We recognize that we can give them time. 2% we think is a doable, but that 2% across the general fund, again, continues to narrow that chart we show you in that gap. And so, again, we're kind of looking at this maybe 2-year period. If we can keep maintaining where we are today in the forecast and then shave a little bit off each year. Now, the goal is, obviously, we'd like to see the revenues grow faster. If the revenues can grow faster and we can maintain our current base of expenditures where they are today and without seeing dramatic increases, then that'll help close the gap even faster, too. And you saw we've been a somewhat conservative on our revenues, and we're hoping that maybe this year we'll see that grow a little bit faster than we expected. If that can maintain and hold itself, then maybe the following year we're not having to continue to ask for more increases. And really what will help us do is what we're getting concerned about and where we work with departments as they identify savings is that list at the beginning, all those life cycle issues that we're and deferred maintenance on buildings. Those are kinds of things that as departments can prove up their savings, we oftentimes go back to them and say, okay, let's go back to that list we started the year with that you identified were important, whether it's radios or self-contained breathing apparatus, whatever, and help them identify the priorities and try to fund those during the year. But it's so this is a cautiously optimistic forecast that we believe that we're doing well and the departments are to be commended for maintaining their expenditures and trying to keep that rate of growth consistent with our revenues. If we are, the optimistic side is that maybe the revenues will grow a little bit faster than we're projecting in here. And if that happens, then that'll help us close that gap. Because right now, what you would see is you're saying, well, how do you maintain this gap? Well, we're eating into our savings each year. Now, what's been nice is we've had some, as Candace mentioned, some times with transit or whatever, and it's provided us.
Right. We just have some timing issues.
Set us some time, so it kind of it helped supplement the reserves, but it was one time. So, but every year, that gap that you see today is about 10.
Yes, it's about and actually on slide 23, if you go in there and you look at where we are today, I kind of have a little box to the right just to kind of give you a couple numbers.
I didn't
and
say
so
that.
Going into 16, 17, we're looking at, you know, if we just look at that gap, knowing what's in there, we're about just under $9 million.
So the more we can, that's what's coming out of savings. That's what's anticipated coming out of savings. Now, every year we expect departments to have some savings, so it's less than that number. 1% can cut that number almost in half. So it's a large number, but overall with expenses and the savings we get from departments, we can, it's manageable. But we just need a little bit more. Really, we're trying to buy time and hold back our expenses as our revenues and hopefully the economy grows to catch up with where we are. So that's kind of our theme going forward this year. But the challenge is, and as we all know, there are lots of pressures out there and demands on a variety of services to increase. And that's our challenge, is the ability to respond to adding additional resources within the base budget right now.
Yes, Mr. Thompson.
And I think this really kind of speaks to exactly what we were talking about last week, Chris, and the need as we come up with projects and things that we want to do, that we prioritize those and actually take a look at them. Because, you know, my concern is that gap isn't narrowing necessarily, and if we continue to spend recklessly, that gap could actually widen and we could deplete our savings altogether.
Right. We have to be careful. But the good news is, on slide 24, We did a pretty good job last year of closing that gap. But you're right. We don't want to lose ground on what we accomplished last year. I think that's a very good point.
Well, the good news is we're going to be wrestling this for the next month or so as we go through our budget hearing. So this has been a great presentation to kind of set the plate for the conversations we need to have about that gap and the long-term efforts to eliminate it. I'm sorry, Candace, were you done with your presentation?
I am. Yes, that's a great segue, Mayor, into the anticipated calendar of when we do expect to come back. So at this time, we are anticipating coming back at the end of this month on March 31st with that proposed budget. That's the one that we do each year that kind of outlines the changes between the current 15-16 budget and the 16-17 budget that we're recommending going into the 16-17 fiscal year. And then we're actually anticipated it really be the month of April to fill every Thursday morning for you with vast amounts of great knowledge about the capital improvement program, the utility rate recommendations, department overviews, those types of things through the month of April.
Great. Thank you. And Council, just to remind you, we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago about our strategic planning model and how we wanted to modify that going forward. And I think the consensus was that we would try to weave that into our budget discussions as well. So in addition to the topics that Candace will be bringing us, Mr. Brady, I think, is going to remind us that we want to use that those study sessions as an opportunity to look at some strategic planning ideas.
Mayor and Council, we're going to try to schedule departments so that they kind of match up with those
strategic priorities
so that there's kind of a when you're talking about that, you have maybe as best as we can try to have those departments that are supporting or related to that strategic plan in that discussion that same day. So they may be spread out over the budget process.
Yes, Mr. Thompson.
That reminds me also, are we going to still have our strategic planning session?
Well, I think that's what we're saying is we're not going to have a strategic planning session. We're going to have a month-long discussion during the process of our budget hearings. We're going to incorporate strategic planning into our budget conversations so that we'll do it maybe a bite at a time and rather than try to just kill it in a half a day retreat or something like that. It's going to be a longer process, hopefully more thoughtful. Hopefully we can establish some baseline numbers by asking, you know, as we're wrestling with the numbers, where are we at? Where do we want to be so we can measure our goals? So we're going to blend the strategic planning session into the budget discussions. And then I think we probably will then have some just pure strategic planning meetings separate and apart from that, but we'll kind of do the due diligence to come up with where we're at and where we want to be during our budget discussions. That's kind of the consensus I took from our discussion of this a few weeks ago. Thank you, Candace. Excellent presentation. Council, any other discussion on this item? The next item on our agenda then is is information on current job order contracting projects. Council, any questions or concerns about those? Seeing none, moving on to hear reports of meetings and conferences attended. Anything? Okay. And then, Mr. Brady, can you help us with scheduling of meetings and general information?
Yes, Mayor, just to remind the council that the study session for next week, I guess that is next week, isn't it? March 10th, wow, has been canceled. We won't have a majority of council here, but the next study session will be 5 p.m. on Monday, March 14th, followed by the council meeting on that same day. And, also let me also mention as an announcement that this Saturday, March 5th, from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. is the Downtown Mesa Brew Fest. It'll be held on South McDonald Street between Main Street and First Avenue. It's free for every your dog and the family and dog, and it's a dog-friendly event. I'm trying to say that, sorry. Family, and it's dog-friendly. So we invite everybody to Downtown Mesa this Saturday from 2 to 6.
Great. And, of course, spring training has started. I know tomorrow, I think most of the council will be at the Cubs game as we kick off the season for the Cubs. So, and the A's also, I think, are that day or the next day as far as their first home
game.
Same day. So for the public out there, we hope they're enjoying a lot of good spring training baseball games. Council, any other items to discuss? If not, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn. Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned.